paving the way for Israeli far-right extremists to enter the mosque. That prompted Palestinians and resistance factions to reiterate their readiness to defend Al-Aqsa and repeat the 2021 Operation Sword Al-Quds if the Al-Aqsa status quo is violated.
The Palestinian used to just look at the situation in the West Bank and Al-Aqsa Mosque. These violations crossed the red line and the Palestinian people began to lose their patience. The Palestinian resistance has something to say if the occupation regime crosses our red line.
Palestinians and Muslims reject the temporal and spatial division of the Al-Aqsa Mosque between Muslims and Jews. This is while Israel keeps violating the internationally agreed status quo of the mosque. Ramadan every year witnesses Israeli attacks against Palestinians gathered in the holy place. In 2021, the expulsion of Palestinian families from their homes in Al-Quds and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan led to an 11-day aggression on Gaza. More than 260 Palestinians were killed during the assault, including 67 children and 41 women. Over 2,000 Palestinians were injured and many more internally displaced.
Our message to the Israeli occupation is that breaching the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque puts Israel on the verge of a collapse. Because our people will never remain silent over these violations, nor will they accept the temporal division of Al-Aqsa.
A surge in Israeli settler violence and military raids on Palestinian towns have claimed the lives of more than 90 Palestinians since the start of this year. That makes 2023 the deadliest year in decades in the occupied East Al-Quds and the West Bank.
We in Gaza are telling you that you can count on us. We support you in each and every step of operation you take against the Israeli occupation regime. We salute your struggle and reiterate our steadfastness toward our land. We will never leave our land.
There are concerns that tensions in the occupied territories would escalate as Israeli forces and settlers continue their attacks on Palestinians and violate their sanctities in clear defiance of calls to stop the violence.
The repeated Israeli attacks against the Palestinians in the West Bank and the regime's flagrant violations of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan have been met with strong condemnations here in Gaza, where people express their unwavering support for Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major dispute with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has in turn led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalizavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families, too, have suffered as a result. They, too, have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France, but unfortunately the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
Quranic verses and anti-Israeli and U.S. slogans rank high in this year's National Day of Resilience demonstration in the capital Sana'a, where protesters celebrated what they called 9 years of successful resistance against the Saudi-led war, which began back in March 26, 2015. Yemen's Supreme Political Council leader, Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, who was present at the demonstration, said the armed resistance against all enemies of Yemen will continue until every inch of Yemeni land is liberated from foreign presence.
We must protect our resistance effort and continue to counter this enemy. We must march forward together and confront this enemy. We must focus more on the battlefront and prepare for it now more than ever before. We must support our Ministry of Defense, which is equipped with men who have the hearts of lions, men who will teach the enemy a lesson they will never forget.
When Saudi Arabia launched its war back in 2015, it said it would destroy all heavy weapons possessed by Ansar Allah and force them to withdraw from the Yemeni capital. What has happened, however, is quite the opposite. The Ansar Allah movement has managed to win the battle across the board, developing sophisticated weapons and taking over more territory. They've also managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the people in the north.
We have been at war for 9 years, and we will continue to go to war for another 90 years if we must. We will never surrender, no matter how much they bomb. Our faith is in Allah, and it will never be shaken.
We came out in this huge protest to send a message to the Saudi-led coalition that we will remain resilient and we will never betray our cause, even if they add another 9 years to the previous 9 years of war. With our military of believers in Allah, we are coming for you. We are coming with our ballistic missile.
According to Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, if the Saudi-led coalition continues its war on Yemen, they will only witness greater losses and a bigger humiliation.
The war that was only supposed to last a few weeks has entered its ninth year. What's even more surprising is that the Yemeni army is stronger now than ever before. That's because they have developed long-range ballistic missiles and drones, which could be used if the war continues. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
A sentiment echoed by other anti-apartheid campaigners here. Among them, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, who've called on the British government to refer Israel and Netanyahu to the International Court of Justice for War Crimes in Palestine.
The protesters here are saying that the UK government's welcoming of Netanyahu is a mark of approval of his right-wing government, that it provides the Israeli regime with further cover to steal more Palestinian territory and to continue with its campaign of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people.
Earlier this week, the UK and Israel signed a so-called 2030 roadmap for UK-Israel relations, strengthening bilateral ties with the regime whose finance minister denies the existence of a Palestinian people.
This is an extreme right-wing government itself. So this is, you know, one proto-fascist government supporting a proper fascist government. So I don't feel that this government is ever representing me on other issues as well. but they are supporting such an excessive, extreme right-wing government in Israel is a shame for all of us.
But while all eyes are on the intensified Israeli violence against Palestinians, others are highlighting another important reason that's dragged an embattled Netanyahu to Europe. His trip comes in the wake of the recent Chinese-brokered rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Netanyahu could be here to gauge European government's position on Iran. From London, the Israeli PM will be flying to Berlin, Germany, where he's expected to be greeted with similar protests. Saeed Bourza, London. A day after a surprise jump in inflation, an expected rise in the Bank of England's interest rate from 4% to 4.25, the 11th increase in less than 2 years.
The Bank of England argues the increase in the interest rate is aimed at reducing inflation. That's amongst the highest levels since 1982. On the other hand, there are some economists who are saying it'll inevitably increase the pressure on many Britons, already being squeezed by the cost of living crisis.
That's because a higher interest rate means a higher cost of borrowing.
It's going to affect people with mortgages, and it's going to affect companies with debt, and there's a lot of companies with a lot of debt.
Today's interest hike comes against the backdrop of this pledge by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in January.
We will halve inflation this year to ease the cost of living and give people financial security.
That is yet to happen. Some economists say some of the inflation rise can be blamed on potentially one-off factors, such as vegetable shortages caused by extreme weather in Spain and North Africa, and British producers not producing for fear of massive energy bills. Others say there are other underlying reasons. The Bank of England was the first to increase interest rates, but not the only one. EU and US central banks have also raised borrowing costs, with the American Central Bank's chair, Jerome Powell, saying there was still a long way to go to tame inflation in the world's largest economy. While Britons continue to contend with the soaring cost of food and energy, would this be the last rate hike by the UK's central bank? Saeed Bourza, London.
Turkey is a pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, and its allies have announced that they will not field a candidate to run against President Erdogan on May 14. HDP co-chairwoman Pervin Buldan made the announcement in a presser for the Labour and the Freedom Alliance, which includes the HDP, the Turkish Workers' Party, and other leftist parties. Although it was not made clear during the conference, the announcement means the HDP will support the opposition National Alliance candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
We will fulfill our historical responsibility against the one-man rule. We are determined to hold this government, which continues a rule based on poverty and corruption. The HDP and its allies will not nominate a candidate for May 14.
The announcement is considered a major setback for Turkish President Erdogan, as the HDP is the third largest party in parliament. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan slammed the opposition bloc's cooperation with the pro-PKK People's Democratic Party, saying alliances should focus on common principles rather than negotiations over seats.
The announcement by the Kurdish alliance that they will not nominate a candidate will make this election difficult for President Erdogan, which means that the Kurdish votes will go to Kılıçdaroğlu. Yesterday, we also heard President Erdogan say that 17 of his ministers and his deputy will run for parliamentary elections to strengthen his party's position in these elections. Erdogan knows his position is not the strongest after the Kurdish alliance announcement and is trying to fix things around him to make sure he wins.
On Tuesday, the day before the announcement, Kılıçdaroğlu met with HDP leadership in the parliament building in Ankara, during which he made promises to remove restrictions on the Kurdish language and address other related issues. The May 14 election looks to be a tough one for the ruling party and its allies. Many say Kurdish voters could play the role of a kingmaker and help the opposition win this time. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
French protests and strikes have brought different sectors of France to a halt. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Reuters reported French energy giant Total has halted production at one of the country's largest refineries as protests and strikes continue against the government's plan to raise the retirement age. Reuters reported citing a company spokesperson. The reported shutdown at Grand-Fréville comes after staff were requisitioned at the site last week to avoid fuel and supply shortages, including at airports in Paris. The requisition at the 240,000 barrel per day BPD refinery have been met with protests by unions. Grand-Fréville supplies the whole Île-de-France region and provides fuel to the capital's main airports. Recently, state forces temporarily managed to disperse refinery workers who were holding a blockade, which helped to resume fuel shipments. However, workers have continued their picket. Industrial action at French refineries has left some petrol stations short of fuel, as well as hitting liquefied natural gas LNG terminals, power supplies, and nuclear reactor maintenance. Energy Minister Agnès Pannier-Runacher stated last week that some 15% of French petrol stations were experiencing disruptions. Protests gripped France recently, with over a million people demonstrating in a nationwide movement against unpopular pension system changes proposed by President Emmanuel Macron. Macron bypassed Parliament and used executive privilege to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64, insisting that the change was necessary to prevent the bankruptcy of the national pension system. The French leader has refused to budge despite trade unions and opposition parties denouncing the measures. Also, according to RT, workers at the Louvre Museum in Paris teamed up with pension reform protesters to block the entrance to the museum. Dozens of protesters, many of them Louvre employees, gathered outside the glass pyramid holding trade union flags. The demonstration stopped tourists from visiting the museum, which houses priceless artworks such as Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa and Caravaggio's Death of the Virgin. France has been consumed by protests and strikes since the government hiked the retirement age earlier this month. More widespread demonstrations are planned, but as the museum is usually closed on Tuesdays, staff there demonstrated a day earlier. Video footage shared online showed small groups of protesters walking through the museum subterranean entrance hall. CGT trade union declared on Twitter, "Join us to support the Mona Lisa on a strike." A follow-up tweet by the union featured an image of an aged and wrinkled Mona Lisa with a caption reading, "64, it's a no." Cities across France have been rocked by protests, some of them developing into rioting and arson, since President Emmanuel Macron's government bypassed Parliament to pass a bill raising the retirement age for most workers from 62 to 64. More than a million people took to the streets. According to the government figures, in Paris, hundreds were arrested after clashing with riot police and setting fires in the streets of the capital. Macron has insisted that he will press ahead with the highly unpopular reforms. Talks between Prime Minister Elizabeth Warren, labor unions and opposition politicians began, but like Macron, Warren has stressed that the government has no intention of abandoning the legislation. According to Guardian, in the capital, the official demonstration made up of a large cross-section of French society, young, old, professional, unemployed, set off from Place de Bastille in the early afternoon and made its way to Place de l'Opéra, along the Gardes Boulevards, the main east-west road through the northern part of central Paris. French union members carrying flags and banners were flanked by their own stewards to ensure their security. The crowd was dense and angry with the government and president, but the mood was also festive and motivated by a show of solidarity. The atmosphere was soured by a group of young people called the Smashers, dressed in black and wearing masks, who had positioned themselves at the head of the march and destroyed bus shelters, advertising hoardings, shop windows, the front of a McDonald's, the newspaper kiosks, leaving a trail of glass and piles of burning bins in their wake. They also pulled up cast iron grills around trees and broke up paving stones, which they then threw at police. The worst clashes took place in Place de l'Opéra and later at Place de la Bastille, where police attempt to disperse them with tear gas.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Here is a part of the speech delivered on March 21, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. I wish to add that our dear people must know that we consume bread wastefully. So much bread is thrown away. The people should know that our agriculture is one of the most dependent sectors on imports. One of the most dependent sectors on imports is the agricultural sector, and it is too dependent. This must be modulated. Of course, combating this dependence is very difficult because some people have very huge interest in the importation of agricultural products and therefore they resist. A few years ago, I asked a minister of agriculture to pursue the matter regarding rapeseed oil, which is an important ingredient for the production of vegetable oil. Basically, he said, of course, he explained it in detail, but this is the gist of what he said, that they do not let this happen because they say that we must import the basic products for oil. In other words, they do not let this happen. They might even use some people in the ministry and inside executive organizations to prevent the production of these inside the country. However, we must stand up against them. This is difficult, but they must do this difficult task. So the first issue is that knowledge-based companies are few in number considering the needs of the country, and the number must increase, in particular in the area of agriculture and surely in all other areas.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Officials should show determination, and showing determination means providing support. This is because knowledge-based companies belong to the people. It is the people and young individuals who establish these companies. But organizations must support them. And support means buying their products or giving them the equipment and resources that they need. Of course, in the report given to me, the ministries that have helped have been mentioned. The same is true of the ministries that have not helped. These issues must be pursued by the Honorable Administration and Honorable President himself. These matters are not within the scope of our work. In any case, the number of knowledge-based companies in every sector can be a yardstick for the progress of that sector in the administration. For instance, if we see that the number of knowledge-based companies have increased in the area of oil, gas, and downstream industries, we could, for instance, give a high score to the Minister of Oil and the other way around, too. In my opinion, this could be a yardstick. So the first point is that knowledge-based companies must increase in number.
That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
the spotlight.
In a sign of growing ties, the Iranian foreign minister has visited Russia. Both Russia and Iran have slammed the U.S. for some of its policies, like how no country should protect its security at the expense of others, or unilateral sanctions on the Islamic Republic, like on the transit of goods. What does the U.S. think about Iran and Russia getting closer? Does the U.S. view even matter? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the two countries will resist U.S. hegemonic actions, while reminding everyone that the world is awaiting Washington's return to the Iran sanctions removal deal known as the JCPOA. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Quetzalcoatl, professor at the University of Tehran and a political analyst, joins us from Tehran. Also joining us is Daniel McAdams, executive director at the Ron Paul Institute, who joins us from Lake Jackson in Texas. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Quetzalcoatl, let me first start with you. This is a very important trip made by the Iranian foreign minister to Moscow. We could say that about every trip. But tell us, first of all, what you think. And doesn't it appear, again, your opinion matters, that this is building up on the previous trips in terms of the things that are being accomplished during the visit of the Iranian foreign minister, for example? Every time that they have met, it's like they're building up on something.
That's very true. I think the U.S. Foreign policy is making Iran and Russia closer to each other on a daily basis. They have a common problem. The United States is sanctioning Russia. The U.S. is sanctioning Iran. There is this hostile policy towards both countries. And the U.S. government officials don't need any excuses. They're accusing Russia in terms of the Ukraine war. Iran has not attacked any countries in the last 200 years. But still, Iran is a subject of U.S. Sanctions. And the relations between Iran and Russia are beneficial to both sides. There are things that Russia has that Iran wants. There are things that Iran has that Russia wants. So this is a true win-win situation for both countries. And I think China is going to be the third country that's going to set this stage for a new world order, where countries that are subjects of U.S. aggression and hostile foreign policy tools are going to get closer to each other to resist the U.S. hegemony.
Part of the what Quetzalcoatl there said, I'd like to expand on it with you more, Daniel McAdams, in terms of this new world order. And obviously that involves the new geopolitics of the region and involves obviously Russia and Iran getting closer. Now, to begin with, isn't that part of the problem that the U.S. has, that it did not have a foreign policy that would prevent these two countries from getting closer together, which, as a result, they have? And how has that gone against U.S. interests?
Well, the more they tried to prevent the two countries from getting together, the more they encouraged them to get together. You know, to U.S. foreign policy, You know, every problem is a nail, and every you know, tool is a hammer. That's all the U.S. has. And in fact, I would say probably, and I was a big supporter of the JCPOA back in, under the Obama administration. I thought that was one of the very few successes they had in foreign policy. But that water has gone under the bridge, you know, years and years ago. And I would actually suggest that the U.S. has done Iran and Russia both a great favor. Certainly Iran, by being so recalcitrant on the deal, by refusing to go back, pardon me, and honor its obligations. Because unfortunately, U.S. diplomacy is based on a unilateral rather than a bilateral agreement. The U.S. comes in and it tells you what it wants you to do, and you have to obey. If not, then it sanctions you. And if that doesn't work, then it tries to regime change you, which has done to Iran several times. As you know, the U.S. is behind, has been behind the Green Revolution, the Hijab Revolution, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the modus operandi where it appears, at least at this point, that the Russian-Iranian developing relationship is based on mutual interest, is based on mutual respect. You don't see Russia trying to tell Iran what kind of government to elect, and vice versa. So in a way, they've probably inadvertently done Iran especially a big favor.
Yeah, in terms of that, I think the wheels, not only have they been in motion, and now it's just it's moving into the new direction. Fuad-Izzati, as you said, that new direction being that this new global world order. Now, since our guests there talked about the sanctions removal talks that's known as the JCPOA, I do have to say that the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that there needs to be a swift resumption of the Iran nuclear deal based on how he said it, and that the world is still waiting for the U.S. to return to its obligations. Is that what's happening?
I think the Russian foreign minister is correct. As you know, Russia is a member of P5+1, the countries that signed the JCPOA. Russia, obviously, is a member of the Security Council. And they have been part of the negotiations since day one. And it was a big mistake for the United States to leave the agreement during the Trump administration. And the Biden administration has continued that policy. Biden could return to the agreement on the first day of his presidency, the same way he returned to the Paris climate. They could return to it, nullify the executive order that was issued by the Trump administration, but he didn't do that. He could give Iran 2 or 3 months to return to the agreement once he decided to return the United States to the agreement. But he refused to do that. It's been more than 2 years since that day, and he continues to refuse to follow the UN Security Council. You know, JCPOA was codified within UN Security Council 2231. So the U.S. A U.N. resolution of the U.N. Security Council, that's something that normally not, is not done. And not only the U.S. is violating the resolution, they're punishing countries that want to follow the resolution, including Russia. The difficulty is within the United States. We have a lot of disagreement in the United States. The majority of people in the U.S. Congress are opposing the nuclear agreement. Even the Democrats, a number of high-ranking Democrats oppose it. And this is the chaos that we have in Washington. So people are waiting for Washington to get its act together and return to the agreement. And we don't see a lot of signs that is going to happen anytime soon.
What do you think about that, Daniel McAdams? I mean, again, the Russian foreign minister saying that the world is still waiting for the U.S. to return to its obligations. We know that Iran is not only sticking to it and it's been following and adhering it to this JCPOA as much as it can. It has had some reversals in terms of what it has done, but it's still not only under the NPT guidelines, but just a couple of weeks ago with the IAEA visiting Iran, we saw how that turned out to be a very, very successful trip in terms of the commitments that Iran said in order to clarify any outstanding issues. So why isn't the U.S. returning to its obligations while the whole world is still waiting, according to the Russian foreign minister, on this matter?
Yeah, I think Foreign Minister Lavrov is right that the world is waiting for the U.S. to return to its obligations, but I think it's for a different reason than it did back when President Trump pulled out. At that time, you know, the sting of sanctions was much stronger than it is now. I think now it's the point, you know, when an organism, for example, gets, you know, an amputation or something, they have to reattach a limb, the synapses have to regrow, the nerve endings have to regrow, and the nerve endings of the Iranian economy have regrown, and they've regrown in a different way, in a different orientation. I mean, both of you gentlemen know better than I do, but we know that Iran is exporting a lot more oil, I think twice as much oil per day than it did just a couple of years ago, exporting more steel, for example. So it's exploring new markets. So I think what Lavrov says means when he says the world is waiting, it's more like the world is waiting for the U.S. to meet its obligations. The world is waiting for the U.S. to be an honest broker. And U.S. foreign policy, of late especially, is incapable of being an honest broker because everything is a zero-sum game. We get everything, you get nothing, you shut up and take it, and that's the end of the story. And the world doesn't work that way, no matter how much American diplomats imagine that it works that way. The world doesn't work that way. Now, it works that way for a while. The U.S. has been able to kick around a lot of smaller countries like Syria and Iraq. But eventually, as we see now with the momentous changes in the Middle East, with several critically important peace deals being brokered by outside powers, we're seeing a massive, massive shift to the point where the U.S. has become increasingly irrelevant in the Middle East. I certainly happen to think that's a good thing. It's a good thing for peace, but whether you like it or not, it simply is a fact.
All right, let's switch gears, and let's talk about one of the points raised by the Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, Fuhrizadeh, and that's about the Caucasus region, in particular, talking about Armenia and Azerbaijan. Now, the Iranian Foreign Minister said that peace talks between the two should occur, and that Tehran is firmly opposed to any interventions from extra-regional states, as Iran has stated, aimed at geopolitical changes in the region. Who is Abdollahian referring to when he says intervention from extra-regional states? I take it to be NATO, U.S., and Israel. Of course, your opinion matters here.
I think Israel is number one. I would rearrange the statement that you just made. Israelis want to use the Republic of Azerbaijan as a stage to cause difficulties, maybe attack Iran from that country. The difficulty that we have is that some people in Washington and Tel Aviv think that the same way Ukraine was used to put pressure on Russia, the same way Taiwan is used to put pressure on China, Azerbaijan could be used to put pressure on Iran. And, you know, historically, for centuries, Iran and Armenia have had borders. What Mr. Amir Abdollahian is saying is that that border between Iran and Armenia needs to continue to exist. Iran is not going to tolerate any government taking over that piece of land. The Israelis' attempt to use Azerbaijan as a place to cause difficulties for Iran is going to fail ultimately because Israel is a failing state, is an apartheid state. Israelis are facing a lot of internal difficulties. And the more aggressive foreign policy they engage in, they cause Israel's demise sooner. So I think given the growing relations between Iran and Russia, Russia is going to, given the Russia's influence in that part of the world, Russia is going to basically make sure that Israeli designs are not going to increase and the pressure that Israel is trying to exert on Iran is not going to succeed.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight
every day on IRIB English Radio.
Do you think that that will happen, and what type of pressure, Daniel McAdams? Because the Russian foreign minister said, quote, we do hope that the current frictions in the relations between Baku and Tehran are of temporary nature. And then he said this will promote the threesome cooperation between Russia, Iran, and Azerbaijan, including mutual interests in the fulfillment of important projects. And then he went on to say some other things. The role that Russia can play in resolving this, in what form or manner would that be, do you think?
I have to just start by saying I've been on that border of Armenia and Iran, and it's an incredibly beautiful part of the world, but that's unrelated. I think Israel has plenty of problems right now of its own. Not only does it have a very, very divided population, not only is it in the grip of, you know, what's looked like a bit of a color revolution, there are a lot of suspicions that Washington has had a role in it. I think before the show, one of your newscasters pointed out that the U.S. is making demands on Netanyahu about judicial reform. That doesn't usually happen very often. Usually it's the other way around, I think. So I think it's got a lot of trouble on its own. I think it's got problems with its relations with Russia. They've always been very careful to maintain these kinds of relations. But the more we see Russia and Iran developing relations, the more we see, for example, them developing relations that involve military trade, the more the Israelis must be feeling nervous because, as we know now, Iran has incredible military technology. It has the capability of certainly to defend itself in the region and beyond, and it has things that people like the Russians want to use in war. So, you know, you do see the waning power of Israel in this, but that doesn't mean, as my colleague pointed out, that they're not going to be busy with their traditional influence in Azerbaijan, trying to put a monkey wrench in. But, you know, it remains to be seen what will happen. It feels to me at this point that Israel is a failing power.
Okay. Well, one of the things that has backfired for the U.S., Fotozadeh, if you agree, is the fact that the U.S. approach towards not only Iran but Russia, and we could also talk about China, has forced these countries to enhance their relations to higher level, especially when it comes to the military arena. And I'd like to ask you, we've seen how Iran, China, and Russia recently, for example, to have held joint military drills. These were maritime drills off the Gulf of Oman, and it's been a number of times that they have done that. But tell us how that is, again, a way for these three countries to have gotten closer because of the wrong U.S. policy approach towards them. And what these military drills mean, like this maritime drill, is that a signal to the U.S.?
You know, China's influence in the Middle East is increasing. The recent agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia was signed in Beijing. They have legitimate interests in this part of the world. They get about 60% of their energy from this part of the world. And they need to be able to protect the interests that they have. Russia is obviously, as we have talked about, is increasing its relations with Iran. The western borders of Russia are blockaded because of the decision that the U.S. has made, and a number of European countries have followed that decision. So Russians are looking south and they see Iran. Securing Iran, making sure that there's cooperation between Iran and Russia is important for the Russian side. And they don't, given the influence of the United States with the Suez Canal, the corridor from southern Iran to northern Iran is going to be important for both Russia and China. They want to see that developed. You need to have security to make sure that the waterways that are in that area are protected. And so, as you said, this is a sign of increased cooperation. And I need to add this point that this confrontation with the United States, it does not need to happen. You know, we have politicians, patriots in the United States like Ron Paul, that have questioned this type of aggressive foreign policy. You could have a situation where these countries cooperate with each other instead of compete or confront each other. But that needs to see a paradigm shift in U.S. foreign policy. There are people in the United States that like to see that paradigm shift. And unfortunately, they're a minority when it comes to the people who are occupying seats in the U.S. Congress or the people who are running the executive branch in the United States. And given the fact that the foreign policy of aggression has failed, the American people hopefully will realize that other options are available, and there are politicians, experienced politicians in the United States that have been advocating that alternative foreign policy, and the hope is that sooner or later American people will listen to that alternative instead of following the failed policies of the past.
Well, that's the whole thing, isn't it? When you take a look at David McAdams, the fact that you have what's not going to happen is that paradigm shift that our guest Fouad Azadi says. The U.S. is not going to change in that respect. When the U.S. says it wants competition with China and that it's healthy, it's not really after competition. It's after what we see as a militaristic approach, undertones of the way that it has approached various issues with China. But because countries are realizing that with the U.S. the options are not there, they've moved on, and the U.S. again is being hurt. Now, in the case of Iran and Russia and China and even other countries like Saudi Arabia, we're seeing the rise of the yuan. We're seeing countries trade in their national currencies. And this is very evident when it comes to these countries like Iran, Russia, and China, and then Saudi Arabia, and then the BRICS from another perspective, where the dollar is obviously being challenged, to say the least, where countries are just de-dollarizing themselves. Again, this goes back to how the U.S. has shot itself in the foot, correct?
Yeah, and you could even extend that to Africa. I think it was the president of Kenya who said a couple of days ago, we need to ditch the dollar. The dollar's dead. So when you see that kind of shift, that means a lot. Americans don't really understand what it means, the de-dollarization that we continue to see, increasing trade in yuan and in local currencies. Americans have not been educated by their government and by the media to the meaning of when the dollar ceases to become the world reserve currency. We've been able to export inflation through dollars overseas. When that ceases, we're going to have to live within our means. We can't use funny money to live above our means anymore. And that's going to be a huge shift for Americans to understand. We're facing a huge recession, if not much worse, in our economy. Banks are failing left and right. The balance sheets are horrible. There's only so much dollars that can be printed in the U.S. to bail these big, well-connected banks out before inflation starts to kill the average American. So all of these policies, these wrong policies that the U.S. has pursued in its failed diplomacy overseas, will come home to roost in the United States. Of course, most Americans won't understand the origin is their own failed politicians and stupid ideas, but nevertheless, they will feel the pain of wrong foreign policies. We can only hope